Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I did that for you.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I'm Liz. I'm an alcoholic. And I have a sobriety date. It's July 27th of 1999. My home group is a stepsisters meeting on Thursday nights in Gaithersburg, Maryland. We meet at 7 o'clock. And I sponsor women in AA, and I have a sponsor. And those things are all very important to me and to my sobriety. Thank you so much for asking me to come down and speak to y'all. I really do appreciate the opportunity to be of service in AA. So a little bit about myself. I grew up in Arlington, Virginia, and my parents are from Texas, and I have two brothers and a sister, so I had a pretty big family, but we're real spread out. My sister is actually almost 7 years older than me, and my two brothers are 20 years older than me, so I had sort of an only child, you know, kind of experience as a child, and I always felt a little different. I didn't make friends easily. I had a learning disability when I was a kid, so I didn't do well in school. And I always felt pretty uncomfortable. Alcohol was always a part of my life. My parents drank regularly. I remember learning how to make martinis when I was maybe 8 years old for my parents at night. My mom always had two, but my dad would basically drink until he went to sleep. And I don't know if my dad's an alcoholic or not. He never got sober or tried to get sober. But I just say that alcohol was always prevalent in my home, and it never seemed abnormal to me to be drunk. You know, that seemed like kind of a normal thing adults did. When I was 14, my parents' marriage fell apart, and my father left. And they'd been married 30 years. It was not on our radar. We were not expecting that to happen. And I only talk about this part of my sobriety, not to say that this is why I started drinking, but to actually talk a little bit about my Al-Anon story, because I sort of took care of things at my household for a few years, trying to make sure everybody else was okay. And I even had a friend who became a drug addict during that time, who I sort of took care of. And simultaneously during that time, I started drinking myself. And I took my first drunk, because I'd been drinking up to that point, you know, in family gatherings, pretty normally, like at Thanksgiving or Christmas. But a friend of mine came over to my house one night when I was in eighth grade, and she was a neighbor who I didn't really like very much. She was blonde and preppy and really pretty and had boyfriends, and I was none of those things. And she asked me, do I have any alcohol? And I said, yeah, I think we have some alcohol in the liquor cabinet. We always have lots. And she taught me how to drink tequila shots. And I remember her cutting up the limes and getting the salt and doing the shots with me. And I remember looking at her after I did about two of those shots thinking, why aren't we best friends? You are so cool. And I am cool. And we should be best friends. And that's, you know, I always tell that story because that was to me like the power of alcohol that I remember at a very young age. And I kind of clarified that, I guess, when I got sober and I would hear the stories in the rooms, because I do remember that perception change of being all of a sudden completely comfortable with who I was and what I had to offer, you know. And I chased that feeling pretty much until I got sober in 1999. But like I said, I had some distractions at that age, and I had to deal with my mom, and I had to deal with this friend of mine. And so I didn't drink as much as I probably would have in those early years. My friend actually ended up getting sober in a program called New Beginnings. And she ended up moving away. Her parents thought, oh, it's the school. And so when I was a senior in that high school, I remember my friend had moved away. And all of a sudden, I had to make new friends and sort of try to establish myself in a different role. And I didn't know how to do that. So I started going to parties, and I immediately started drinking, you know, with people to get comfortable. And it worked very well. And, you know, I'd always drunk to get drunk. Like, I didn't know how to have just a glass of wine. You know, I basically would either be abstinent or I would drink. And that's what I'd been playing with all those years in high school, where I just wasn't drinking because I had this crazy friend and I had to make sure my mom was okay. And then all of a sudden everybody seemed to be okay and I was off to the races. That fall, I got in early admission to my college of choice in Philadelphia. And I remember making the conscious choice that I was going to drink after that because I had time to drink and I didn't have to worry about anything anymore. And I remember just kind of even thinking to myself, it's my turn. And I almost didn't graduate high school. And up to that point, I had been a good student, you know, and not an A student for sure, because like I said, I did have a learning disability, but I did do well in school. I had like a 3.2 GPA, and like I said, I got into college. But all of a sudden, I wasn't going to class. I was sleeping in and going to pick up my friends for lunch and stealing wine at the 7-Eleven. And, you know, alcohol came first. And I luckily had gone to a very small high school in Arlington. And the teachers noticed. You know, it didn't come unnoticed. And only because of those teachers did I finish high school, because they called me out and said, "What's going on with you?" And, you know, looking back on that, especially I have a friend who I got sober with who has a very similar story as mine up to that point. But when she got called out, she kind of got sober. And I just looked at it as like a diversion. And I guess the other thing that happened during that time was that everybody said, "Well, Liz is just acting out because of all the stuff that happened. And, that, you know, she'll be okay. She'll be okay." But I was not going to be okay. And, you know, all the stuff that I was doing my senior in high school really just kept playing out into my early 20s. And when I went off to college, my primary purpose at college was to drink. And I didn't really know what else to do there besides drink and sleep around. And that's pretty much all I did. My moral compass was really off by this point. And even though I had grown up in a relatively healthy environment, you know, I knew right from wrong. I didn't have any of those values when I went off to school. And I made a lot of really bad decisions. When I was about 2 years into school, I dropped out. And, you know, I was definitely embarrassed about that decision. And when I came home that summer to tell my mom, she was selling our house. And she bought a two-bedroom condo and turned one of the other bedrooms into a TV room. So there really was no place for me to live. And I was 19. And I did what most 19 young girls that were attractive would probably do, is I met a boy. And I always talk about this part of my story, too, because I fell in love with an alcoholic. So, and he was getting sober in AA when I met him. And I was trying to kind of get my act together. I knew that my drinking was a problem by this point, but I didn't label myself an alcoholic by any means. I just knew that I was not able to manage my life in the way that I knew was acceptable. So I tried to stop drinking as well. And by this point, I think I probably had not crossed that line that a lot of us will cross, because I was able to just stop, you know. And I was working at a deli across the street from my apartment. And my then boyfriend was going to meetings every day, very happy in sobriety, very happy in AA. I remember him actually doing his four-step in my living room when I was in my bedroom, which now I look back on that, it was kind of odd that they didn't leave. But it was definitely a part of our everyday life that he was in AA and that he was getting sober. And I started to have a lot of itches, you know. I was working at this deli that sold beer, and we would go into the bathroom and shotgun beer during our shift. And then I would come home, and I would want to drink more beer, but I wasn't allowed to because I was living with a sober alcoholic of AA. And even though I was madly in love with that man, I was able to walk away from that relationship pretty easily because I thought, I need to drink, and I want to start smoking again, and I don't want to be involved with somebody that goes to AA every night. And I talk about that story, too, because I had a resentment against AA for a few years, you know, from that whole relationship, because I really blamed AA for that relationship not working out, which is a total lie, but that's what I thought. And also, you know, I should mention that I was raised atheist as a child, and I did not believe in God, and I thought people that believed in God were foolish. So that was another sticking point for me with this man, is that I just thought, I can't be with a man that, you know, does all this stuff. And at one point, I remember him even trying to get me to go to AA because I had been drinking off and on at this point. And when I drank, like I said, I got drunk. I didn't just have a beer after work. So he would have to come get me, you know, passed out at some party, or I would call him from some club and I didn't know where I was. And he would say, you know, your drinking is not really normal. And I would be like, leave me alone. What are you talking about? You're the one with the problem, not me. So I was 21 years old, and I was living in a group house in Georgetown by this point, and I started waiting tables. And waiting tables for me was like Mecca alcoholism, you know, because all of a sudden I was with people that completely supported and encouraged my drinking. no holds barred, you know. I would go to work, and all we would talk about is where we were going to go after work. And then we would, you know, drink until we got drunk, and then we would all go home and talk about the next day where we were going to go out to drink. And that's all we did was drink and work and drink and work and drink and work. And I had a pretty good work ethic in the sense that I kept my jobs, mainly out of necessity because I needed money. and I did well at work. I was a hard worker. And that sort of enabled me for a long time in my sobriety to think that I wasn't an alcoholic, you know, because I didn't necessarily get fired always because of my drinking, although I did lose jobs. But I would rationalize all those things where, like, you know, that wasn't because of my drinking. But alcohol was always a major component of my life during those years. And that was about 5 years of my life. So I went from restaurant to restaurant, and I ended up staying at one restaurant for about 4 years called the Old Ebbitt Grill. It was about 2 blocks from the White House in D.C. It was a very busy restaurant, and I made a lot of money. In fact, I made about the same amount of money that I make now. And I had too much money. You know, I mean, I was making more money than I could have ever needed, and I was spending it all on alcohol and drugs. And I was living alone. By this point, I, you know, had burned a couple bridges. I had been living with girlfriends, and they would do something I didn't like, and I would just leave. And I was making enough money that I could afford this little studio up on Mass Avenue. And I was working, and I was just doing what I wanted, and I was miserable, you know, even though I seemingly had everything I needed. But I was desperately lonely and very unhappy, and I kept just getting myself into more and more shameful situations. You know, I'd been sleeping with my assistant general manager for like a year and a half off and on. I had a horrible reputation within this community of people that I worked with, and I was just embarrassed about my life in general. I didn't really know which way I was going. And I started wanting to do something else with my life. And at this point, I started wanting to be a chef. And then also I wanted to tell, one of the little stories I like to tell about during this time, about how I lived. So I remember once I was driving up Wisconsin Avenue with one of the men that I was dating, and he was distracting me in the car, and I ran into a car. And I wasn't driving that fast, but I had a little Volkswagen box, and it got totaled. And I hit a big truck. And I went and parked that car at my apartment building, and I didn't have insurance that would cover the cost of my car. And I just let that car park there. And one day, I came out, and the car was gone. And I remember thinking, oh, that's so good. That's just not there anymore. I don't have to deal with that. Like, that's really how I lived, you know. I remember another story I always like to tell is that I used to come home a lot, drunk, and smoke pot. So I would come home, and I'd be totally drunk, and then I would smoke a bong, and then I would pass out. And one of these nights, which I'm sure I did this many times, I threw up all over my bed. And when I woke up the next morning, I took all my sheets and my comforter, and I just put them in a ball, and I went out and put them in the dumpster. And then I went out and bought all new sheets, because that's how I had to live, you know, because I really couldn't see things for how they were. I had to just sort of, you know, put that away. And I didn't realize any of that was happening when it was happening. You know, I thought I was just sort of dealing with the problem. And actually, I remember one of my greatest accomplishments when I got sober was that my vacuum broke, and I went to the store and got the part, and I fixed it. And I thought, oh, my God, I fixed the vacuum. I didn't just throw it away and go buy a new vacuum, because that's what I'd always done. So when I was about 25 years old, I decided that I wanted to leave the waitress business and become a chef. And I was always hanging out in the kitchen, and I really liked the cook. I liked talking to the cooks, and I loved learning about food. So I started wanting to do that. And I, you know, I've always been relatively outgoing. And I called the owner of the company I worked for, which was Clyde's Restaurant Group. Just like looking back on that, was kind of brave of me. And I said, I want you to see if you can get me a job as a baker in one of your restaurants as a volunteer so I can learn a little bit about this profession before I go off to school. I said, okay, that's fine. So they got me a job. And it was volunteer. And I worked there 3 mornings a week with the pastry chef at the 1789 restaurant in Georgetown. It was a great opportunity, and I was doing really well. And I was trying to keep my drinking under control at this point. In fact, one of the things I did, I started working the breakfast shift, so that I would have to get up at 6 in the morning, and I would think, okay, if I get up early, I won't drink late. And I was really trying to manage all my drinking. You know, I was trying not to do things, you know. And I was doing really well for this for about 4 months. And I had to work for this lady for 6 months to get a recommendation letter to go to the culinary school that I wanted to go to, which was the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America in New York. And about 4 months into it, I went out on a bender, and one day I woke up, and I was supposed to be at the bakery, and I couldn't get there. I couldn't get out of bed. And I couldn't call because that would be embarrassing. I didn't know what to say. And I remember just rolling over in bed and thinking, I just don't want this anymore. That's okay. And I just gave that up, you know, and I'd worked really hard for that dream. And all of a sudden I thought, well, I can't go to that school anyway. It costs too much money. I'll just do something else. So I changed my dream, you know, and I think a lot of us do that in our drinking. So I decided to go to school locally, which turned out to be a perfectly good choice. But like I said, I came this close, you know, and I just gave it all up because my drinking was more important. And I guess it was around the fall of 98. I had applied to the school I went to, and I was seemingly trying to get my act together, but I was still, like I said, going on these benders. And I wasn't drinking every day at this point, but I was drinking often. And I went out one night, and this is all a very blurry memory to me, but when I woke up the next morning, I had fallen something, because I had like a gash on the side of my face, and I had blood like all running down my face, and I had a huge bruise on the top right above my breast, and I didn't remember any of it. And I was supposed to be at work at 7 o'clock that morning. And I remember looking at myself in the mirror. I didn't recognize myself. You know, I was 26, and I got in my car. This is so crazy that I did this. And I knew that I couldn't just call my work. You know, I'd worked there for 4 years by this point. I couldn't just call my work and say, I'm sick, I can't come in. I had to drive there, walk in, show them my face, and explain to them that I'd been mugged the night before. I even went out and bought a new bag so that in case someone noticed that I had the same purse, they wouldn't think twice about it. I mean, that's how delusional I really was at this point, you know. And I made up this whole story about how I was hailing a cab and someone came over and hit me with a rock and, like, took my purse and, why didn't you come back in the restaurant? I don't know. I just, I don't really remember. You know, I mean, I don't even know how I got away with that. But so many of the people I worked with at that restaurant were alcoholic. I'll be honest with you. We all just kind of co-signed each other's shit. I mean, you know, it's just really, like, we all just kind of were like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, even my GM, I remember one time saying to me, his father had owned an Irish pub in New York. And he was like, yeah, we're all just a bunch of alcoholics. I mean, that's how we talked about it. You know, it was just part of who we were. We took pride in it. You know, and actually, I do remember one person getting sober in that restaurant, and he was obviously an AA. He didn't say it to me, but he came up to me once after that happened, because I got dry after that spell for about 7 months, and I was sitting at the bar one day drinking iced tea. What the hell? And he said, you know, I've been sober now for some amount of time, and my life is so fulfilling, and I have a wide variety of people in my life, and I'm just so happy. And I was like, okay, back off. You know, I was not having it. So after that whole instance, I got dry, and you know, I still even remember that sobriety day because it did mean something to me. But I did not go to AA. So that was November 2nd, and I stayed dry for 7 months, which is a really long time not to pick up a drink. I even quit smoking. I quit biting my nails, and you know, back then some of you remember Blockbuster Video. We call that Blockbuster sobriety, because basically what I did was I didn't date, I didn't go to social events. I worked and rented movies, and I went to school, and that's all I did, because I couldn't be in a social situation with anybody and not want to drink. How do you do that? I don't know how to do that. I'm 26 years old, and I haven't done that yet, you know. So that's what I did, and I got pretty involved in school. I started culinary school that year in February, and I loved it. I really enjoyed it, and I was good at it. I had a natural affinity for working in a kitchen, and I did really well. And if you actually look at my transcripts from those years, like every month I had like a 90 or above average. And then July hits, because that's when I relapsed, and my average is 52. And so what happened is in June of that year, a friend of mine came by who I hadn't seen in a little while. You know, we all had the story, right? And she'd been in Scotland, I remember, for some work thing. And her name was Liz, too. And we used to call each other Liz Squared. We used to drink a lot together. And she showed up at my house with like 2 bottles of wine. And I remember looking at her and just thinking, well, I have to drink. She's here from Scotland, you know. And I'll be okay. I'll just stop tomorrow again, you know. But of course I couldn't do that, you know. And once I started again, I couldn't stop. And it was worse than ever. It was funny. I mean, I really don't know why I thought I could stop, you know. But it just, I had stopped before. So I thought, well, I'll be able to stop again. But I couldn't stop. And I had everything to live for at that point. You know, I was almost done with school. I was supposed to graduate in August. I was house sitting for a woman, so I wasn't paying rent. And, you know, I was only having to work 3 days a week. My life was pretty cushy. And I just started drinking. and like I'd never stopped. And I remember it was summer, and I would come home from school. I worked, my school was from 12 to 4, and I would pull up at the 7-Eleven and to buy cigarettes, right? And I would go in, and I would go, well, I'll just get these two magnums of white wine, and I'll bring them home, and I'll stop tomorrow. And then I would go home and fill up a large glass with ice, and I would pour the wine on top of the ice, and I would sit and watch Friends on TV and live vicariously through these ridiculous people's lives on TV. And just drink until I passed out around 10 o'clock. It was a pretty lonely life, you know. And like I said, I started not being able to go to school, and I would miss classes, and I would, you know, not function like I normally could, because I was not a functioning alcoholic by any means. So during that time, and this is where my story gets a little personal, but I like to share it because I think it's important. You know, one of the problems I had was sleeping with men that I didn't know. And so during that month, I slept with a man that I barely knew. He was a bartender at the restaurant I worked at. And I remember I was so embarrassed about this story for a long time because, you know, I really wasn't drunk. I think I'd had one drink. I'd driven all the way over there to basically have sex with this man. And I didn't have the courage or the concern for my own health to ask him to put a condom on. I didn't have the self-esteem to even do that when I look back on it, you know. And I got pregnant. And I remember when I found out I was pregnant, I think it was probably mid-July, and I called a friend of mine in California. And this is the same friend I was telling you about in high school that was a heroin addict who'd gotten sober. And I called her up, and I was like, I don't know what's wrong with me. I keep getting myself in these situations. I'm such a loser. If I had a nickel for every time I said, what's wrong with me? I don't know what's wrong with me. What's wrong with me? And she said, you know, Liz, I think you should go to AA. And I said, are you crazy, Dana? I cannot go to AA. Those people all believe in God. And she said, you know, just go to 5 meetings. And in 5 meetings, you know, you can figure out what you want to do. And so I always say, you know, after 5 meetings, I had a sobriety date. I had home group. And I had a sponsor. And I've been sober since my first meet, which is really a big miracle. Because, I mean, I've been trying to stop drinking for a long time. And, you know, like I said, I would pull up the hall inside that 7-Eleven and just buy those bottles of wine and every day think, I'm just going to stop tomorrow. I'm just going to stop tomorrow. And I couldn't stop. So my first meeting was on July 27th of 1999. And it was very similar to this meeting. It was a lot of men. And I remember I pulled up, and there was, like, all these bikers outside, and, like, smoking, like, in the walkway, like, when you're trying to get into the church. And I was really uncomfortable. And I ran into the meeting. I sat down, and it was a speaker meeting like this. And there's two speakers. And the first speaker I barely remember, but the second speaker was a woman. And she told my story. I related a lot to her. Like, one of the things that I remember she talked about distinctly was ransacking her kitchen to find alcohol one night, and I had done that like 2 days before. You know, like going and trying the vanilla bottles and whatever I could find, anything I could get, because I was out of alcohol. And I remember picking up a one-day chip in that meeting. I remember the sweetest man coming up to me and giving me a where and when, and I didn't have any money, and he was like, that's okay. And I was trying to leave the church afterwards, like we all do, right? And she grabbed me, like, by the shoulder as I was walking out the door. And she said, where are you going? What are you doing? I said, I'm just going home. I got to go to work tomorrow. You know? I said, are all the meetings like this? You know, because I had a hard time with men when I got sober. I know a lot of women that said they hated women when they got sober. I was not one of those people. Like, I wanted to get to know more women. And so she said, why don't you go to a women's meeting tomorrow night? And I said, okay, they have those? That's great. I'll do that. So I went to a women's meeting the next night in Arlington, right across from the hospital. It was like a halfway house, actually. And that's where I met my first sponsor. And I remember a woman there who I still know today took my hands after the prayer. She took both of them, you know, after we prayed. She grabbed both my hands like this. And she said, where are you doing now? I said, nothing. You know. She said, well, come with us. We're all going to another meeting down the street. I was like, oh, my God, 2 meetings in one day? And this I always think is amazing. She was 20 years old, and she got into my car. I was driving. I was 2 days sober. Like, she didn't know me from anything. And she talked the whole way there. We drove all the way down to McLean. and telling me her story, telling me all about how she got sober when she was 16, you know, everything. And I was just like, who is this lady? And they brought me into this meeting, and we got there late, so I didn't get to pick up a chip or anything like that. But they obviously went around and grabbed people, because like 30 women came up to me after the meeting and were like giving me their phone numbers and telling me to call them. And, you know, I just was completely inundated with AA lingo. And I did have to go, because I did have to work at 7 o'clock the next morning. And the next day, that same woman came and picked me up. And I got a sponsor a couple days later. I remember on a Saturday night, I asked her to be my sponsor. And she helped me, you know, with all the preliminaries of being sober. Like, she helped me get service positions. I was making cookies at the Sunday night meeting in Midtown, some of y'all know about in D.C. At my first week, they said, oh, you're a pastry chef? Oh, you can make cookies for that meeting. I said, okay. And then they said, hey, you can greet. So I stood in the line and greeted people. I was a waitress. I knew how to talk to strangers. That wasn't hard for me. So I had service at that meeting right away. And I just got swept up, you know. I had people picking me up every day, taking me to the meetings I was supposed to go to, getting there super early. That drove me crazy in the beginning. You know, we'd get there at 6 o'clock and the meeting would start at 8. I'd be like, what are we doing here? Well, we got to set up the chairs, we got to make the coffee, and we got to, you know, we're all going to hang out. And I just did not get it at all. It drove me crazy. And getting stuck in someone's car for hours after the meeting, taking like 5 people home, things like that. But I just went with it because I had nothing else to do, you know. I was pretty desperate. I had burned all my bridges. I didn't have any friends. You know, I didn't even tell you all those stories, but I mean, I'd had a lot of conflicts with people in my drinking. It wasn't like I had left people unscathed. and nobody was calling me. You know, there was nobody saying, where are you? Why aren't you at the party? You know, nobody cared where I was. So I'm lucky in that sense, because honestly, I do see a lot of people come into AA and they have a lot of back doors, and I didn't have any. I didn't have anybody, you know, asking me to come out with them. You know, I had AA. And, you know, people always say, don't make any major changes your first year. And I changed everything about my life in my first year of sobriety. You know, every single thing. You know, I changed my career. I changed where I lived. I changed my work. I changed all my friends. Everything changed. And that's what happened for me, you know. So one of my first experiences in sobriety was, I had an opportunity to have an internship in New York City when I was about a month sober that I had applied for before I got sober. And they called me on the phone. I was about 2 weeks sober, I think, when they called me. And they said, hi, you know, we'd like you to come up for an interview at this bakery up in New York City. And I said, oh, my God, I can't do that. I'm getting sober, right? And I told my sponsor about it. And I had a number of people in AA, I'll be honest with you, tell me that you can't do that. You know, you can't do that. And my sponsor turned to me and she said, Liz, you're pursuing a dream in sobriety, and that's a beautiful thing. And she supported me through that. And it was really hard. I mean, it was really hard. It was a very challenging internship. And one of the agreements we made, and I don't remember whose idea it was, but I came home every Saturday on a bus, and I went to the meeting at Saturday night that we always went to, and I made cookies for the Sunday night meeting that I go to. And I went to the Sunday night meeting, and then I got back on a bus every Monday morning and went back to New York for my job. And honestly, I didn't think anything of that. I remember thinking, that's what I have to do, right? That's what I should do, otherwise I won't stay sober. I mean, that's really what I thought, and I'm grateful for that now. It never even occurred to me that I wouldn't have to do something to that level. And I think that's what they mean by going to any lengths. You know, I had to do that because I had to be accountable in my sobriety, otherwise I was not going to stay sober. And I was not accountable in New York. I went to meetings every day in New York, but nobody knew me. I didn't get to know people. I was working 12 hours a day. But I went to a meeting every day in New York, and it was really fun. I got to see a lot of different things up there. And like I said, I worked all the time, so I wasn't like a tourist. But I did get to see a little bit of a different view of AA up there, which was kind of nice, given that my home group can be a little secluded, you know what I mean, because we all know each other, we all see the same people. And I got to see a lot of different things right away, you know, a lot of different kinds of sobriety. And I'm grateful for that. And I did that for 3 months. And then I came home, and I got a new sponsor when I got back. And Kim and I are still good friends today. But I just kind of decided during that time that I wanted someone a little older, someone a little further down the path than me. And Kim was only a year sober longer than I was. And I had met this woman, Karen, who, I don't know, she just had like a light in her eyes that I just loved. She would sit there and you would look at her and you'd think to yourself, she really is comfortable with who she is. And that's what I wanted. You know what I mean? I wanted someone that was really comfortable with who they were, because I was not. I was not comfortable with who I was and what I'd become. And Karen has been an amazing example to me, and she's still my sponsor today. 17 years later, which is crazy. We actually just went and saw someone we love who's an author at the Strathmore, and it was really fun. And so let's see, what else? And then my first year sober, I met my husband. So I was 9 months sober. I wasn't a year sober when I started dating. I didn't date at all my first 9 months. Mike is actually the only person I dated in AA. I was adamant about not dating. I did have a number of offers, but I said, nope, I'm getting sober. I'm not going to date. And I remember coming to my sponsor's house one day, I had this weird epiphany that I was afraid of dating because I didn't think anyone was actually going to like me for who I was. And my sponsor said, well, that kind of means that you're going to have to maybe date somebody because you're going to have to walk through that fear. And I was like, ugh. And I remember her giving me all these rules about dating because I thought dating was like you meet someone, you like them, you sleep with them, and you see what happens. That's not what dating is. So she gave me lots of rules, you know, 5 dates before you have any physical activity, things like that. And a date is an actual planned event with a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's not like come over to my house and let's watch a movie. But anyway, so I met Mike, and, you know, Mike is wonderful, and I know he came down here to speak, and I don't know if it's appropriate or not, but I do attribute a lot of my sobriety to my husband because he's such a wonderful example of AA. And I think the foundation of our marriage is AA, and I think that's why we have a successful marriage. So I do think it's a good thing to mention in a podium talk. You know, our best conversations are about AA, not about our kids, not about our sex life. It's almost always about, you know, what happened at the meeting and who did you talk to and who are you helping? And, oh, so-and-so's coming over tomorrow morning. Okay, I'll make sure I make y'all breakfast. Things like that. And, you know, even our wedding, we planned around AA. I remember I wanted the wedding to be at 8 o'clock because that's meeting time. And it was not a formal affair. Like, it was formal, but we didn't have, like, seating arrangements because I wanted to be invited as many people as I could. And I was inviting, like, newcomers to my wedding, you know, at the last minute. And it was, like, 250 people. And it was like an AA dance almost. It was like a big party. And we had a DJ and we had food. I remember the food was very important. I was like, can't go to a wedding where we have to sit around and wait to eat because people are going to be annoyed. Because I know my friends in AA and they're going to be annoyed if they have to sit around and wait for the food. So we have to have the food available immediately. You know, we had the wedding and everybody turned around and there was the food. And it was just a big party. And even our honeymoon, I remember us planning it by talking to people in AA that had been to this place because the AA was good. Because we went to a meeting every day on our honeymoon at 6 o'clock. And actually, and my husband will agree to this, we had a wonderful honeymoon in St. John, and it was 10 days. And one of the absolute best nights we had there was going out to dinner with two old-timers, Bill and Annie. They were like 30 years sober and on the island, and they took us out to dinner. And it was just such a joy to spend time with them. You know, and we loved each other dearly, but it was just, there's something about being with people in AA that turns you on. It makes you bright, you know, it just gives you life. And I just know that my husband and I would not be who we are if we didn't have AA and having other interests in our lives besides each other. So that was pretty miraculous. And I guess a couple other stories I like to tell. So when I was... I guess around 5 years sober, I started having to deal with a lot of the shame that I dealt with, that I should have been dealing with all my drinking. And I think a lot of women go through this, so I tend to mention it, you know, in passing, where, like, when I did my four-step, I did a thorough four-step. There was nothing I left off that list. But when I read my four-step and did my fifth step with my sponsor, I was not connected to a lot of those things that I did. There was, like, a certain disconnect. Like, I was talking about somebody I knew or something I saw, you know? And I don't know, when I was like 5 years sober, I started to have a real connection of like some of those past events, and especially dealing with you know, the abortions and the unplanned pregnancies. That was really hard, and having to really take into account some of those situations. And I had my son, my first son. And I remember my first son was sick when he was born, and he was in the hospital, and so I didn't get to take him home. You know, the first day, and every woman, I think, imagines coming home with their baby, you know, right after they're born. And I came home to an empty house and a nursery that was empty, and then the child was in the ICC, and it was really scary. And I remember I picked up a phone list that I had of women in my women's group that I go to, and I called the first name. It was Ashley. And I called her and I told her what happened. And she said, I'm going to call you right back. And she called me right back. And like 10 women came to my house for a meeting that night, you know, because I was pretty shooken up. And that's what the women have always done for me in AA. They've just carried me through AA. And, you know, that process of dealing with the shame of my past, it took about 2 years. You know, it wasn't like something I just talked about in meetings once and all of a sudden felt better about. I had to work with other alcoholics. I had to do a lot of inventories on it. And I had to do a lot of forgiveness for myself, which has been incredibly healing but very painful. But I'm very grateful for that experience. You know, I believe in sharing. I think that's one of the things that's definitely kept me sober. You know, I share in meetings. I share where I'm at. I share what's going on. Share my recovery. I don't keep it all to myself. I don't like telling stories after I've already figured it all out because I have a lot more to go. And so one of the things that I dealt with a lot in my drinking was entitlement. And again, this is like all the stuff on my four-step. But I was a thief, you know. I was a liar and a thief. And if you had what I wanted, I took it. And that's what I did. And like I said earlier, I didn't have a lot of moral values for some reason when I was drinking. I was able to like push all that aside. And I thought I'd kind of dealt with most of that because I stopped stealing, you know, when I got sober. But my husband and I had a lot of financial struggles, I guess, during this time. And I started doing little things at work. Like I would take home cookies from work or, you know, what happened was a friend of mine was having a baby and she asked me to hold a shower for her. So I brought home some cupcakes from the bakery. And I didn't pay for them. And I didn't think anything of it at the time. And I was 11 years sober. I mean, it's embarrassing for me to tell you the story, but this is what happened. And I went back to work that next week, and I got fired. And I'd been at that baker for 5 years. And I'd had many promotions, and I was making good money. And I couldn't believe it. You know, I really couldn't believe it. My boss took me into the office and said, you know, they saw you bringing out the platter the other day. And I said, well, I was going to pay for it. I was going to pay for it, you know. And I knew I was caught, and I begged him for my job back, but he wouldn't give me it back. And they escorted me out. It was one of the worst days of my life, I'll be honest with you. I mean, it was horrible. And I had a 9-month-old baby, a 5-year-old child, and I had to come home and tell my husband what happened. And it was horrible. And it's funny, you know, and I think people all meant well by doing this, and it's nothing wrong with them, but nobody said, oh, you shouldn't have done that. It was like, oh, those horrible people. I can't believe they did that to you. That's awful, you know. And I remember my sponsor said that to me, and my mom said that to me, and my husband said it to me. And the more they would say it to me, the sicker I would feel. And I remember finally getting up and leaving that room, and I could barely hold my 9-month-old. I remember him giving me the baby, and I was like, I can't hold the baby. I feel so sick to myself about myself. And I went into the office, and I typed a letter to my boss, or the owner of the company, acknowledging what I'd done, you know, and taking responsibility for it. And I remember distinctly saying in the letter, I treated your business as if I owned it, and I did not, and I'm sorry for that. And I wrote a check, and I put it in the envelope, and I mailed it. And nobody told me to do that, you know. I did that within 3 hours of getting fired. And I believe today that was God, you know, because I don't have the power to do things like that. And I had to do that, you know, to be able to move forward and get past that and be able to live with myself, because it was a horrible thing that I did. It was stupid and horrible. And and I was able to get a new job within about a month, and I hated it. I hated this job so much. I can't even tell you how much I hated it. I would get in my car every morning. By this point, my husband was in school. He had gone back to college. He just started, and he was staying home. He wasn't working. So I was the primary breadwinner in my family. Scary. And I, so I was going to work. I had to go to work. I was there about 3 months, and one day my boss pulled me into his office, and he said, you know, I'm just getting the sense that you're not really happy, and we just want to make sure you're happy because we really want you to be successful here, and we want you to do well. And I'll never forget this because I had this, like, internal thing in my gut. My sponsor would always say to me, like, in third-step conversations, she's like, you don't always know when you're doing the right thing, but you do always know when you're doing the wrong thing. And I knew that I shouldn't stay at that job. Like, there was something inside me that was like, ugh. Can't stay here. I'm like stealing from these people if I stay here because I'm not doing my job the way I need to do it, you know. So I stood up in this meeting and it was like all men. I remember it was like six men sitting around this table And I remember standing up and saying, you know, you're right. I'm not giving you 100%, and you should probably find someone else to do this. And I got up and I shook everybody's hand, and I went out and got my tools, and I said goodbye to some of the people I worked with. And I got in my car, and I was, like, shaking by this point, you know, and I called my sponsor, and she lived really close by, so I drove right over to her house. And, excuse me, and I remember talking to my sponsor that day. I said, you know, I just feel like there's something else I'm supposed to be doing. I don't know what it is, but I think there's something else, and I know that I want a job that has maybe a little bit more meaning. I feel like I'm just making rich people rich. I remember saying that. And I don't know. I just think there's something else. And she's like, well, you just got to pray on it, and we'll see what happens. So I went home, and I remember it was my son's birthday because he was turning one, and he took his first steps when I got home. That was really cool. So it turned a sad day into a happy day. You know what I mean? Like, he helped it. And then we were watching TV at night and put the kids to bed. And I got up and I went and started applying for jobs on the internet like they all do, right? And 30 minutes later, I got a phone call. And this woman answered, I answered the phone. Hi, this is Sarah Milner from Sunflower Bakery. And I'd like you to come over and talk to us about this position that you just applied for. I said, okay. So I went over and talked to them. And it was for a pastry chef position at a bakery that teaches people with disabilities how to bake and then helps get them jobs in different bakeries in the area. And I was like, what? You know, like, are you kidding me? Like, seriously, this is what's going to happen? And I had to take a huge pay cut for that job. It was like $15,000 less than I've been making. But I really do believe, I know it's kind of corny, but I just believe that that all happened for a reason. You know, like, I would never have looked for that job if I hadn't left this other job because it was such less money. Like, I never would have done that, you know? But it was a half a mile from my house. That's the other thing. I swear to God, it was literally down the street and around the corner. I can walk there if I want to, but I drive. And so I started working there about 6 years ago. I love it. It's given me tremendous meaning in my life. I don't get to as many meetings as I would like. You know, when I got sober, I went to 7 meetings a week, sometimes 10. When I had my kids, I started going to 5. Now I go to 4, which is right. It's all right for me. I'd like to go to meetings every day. My husband and I joke about it someday that we'll get to do that again. But right now we can't. But my job gives me a lot of purpose, which is really great. Actually, a student of mine graduated culinary school today. It's amazing to me. He went to Sunflower Bakery and did our training program and then decided 3 years later he wanted to go to culinary school, and so he went to Boston and to Le Cordon Bleu. And today he sent me a picture of his graduation. And that made me feel really good. And so, I mean, my job, I know it's not, you know, all our stuff that we have is work and everything like that, but for some reason that's really given me a lot of meaning in my life. And I guess the other thing I'll talk about is my father, because I mentioned to you that my father left me when I was 14. And again, I don't know if my dad was an alcoholic or not. When I was early in my sobriety, my dad had a stroke, and it was caused a little bit by drinking, they said. And I remember going into the hospital. I brought a friend of mine from AA with me, and I said to him, I said, Dad, you're going to have to stop drinking because, you know, I want you to be around for me. And I've been sober now for 3 months, and I want you to be around. And, you know, he stopped drinking after that for a long time. And that was pretty miraculous, too. And my father and I never had an intimate relationship, I would say. He did come back, and my mom and him ended up mending their relationship. They didn't get remarried, but he lived with her, and all was well. And I guess what I like to talk about with that is that I forgave him for that, because that was a tricky part of my fourth step. You know, I didn't have a part in that relationship. I didn't do anything to cause him to leave me and my mom. My part was holding on to that pain, and I had to let go of that pain and accept my father for the human that he was, and, you know, learn to love him for that person. And that's what I did, and it was painful. And my husband will tell you, because I had to do a lot of that kind of with him, honestly, because I would project some of my stuff from my dad onto my marriage. But through a lot of working the steps and working with my sponsor, I was able to get through that too. And when my father died, I guess a little over 4 years ago, so I went to my brother's house that day, and he... My dad's so funny. My dad, like I said, was a major atheist, and he didn't want to live old. He didn't want to be old. And he was 79 when he died, so he lived a long life. But he did not ever want to get sick. My dad's birthday is in October, and every October he would drive out to the Shenandoah Valley and take a, you know, like a tour of the foliage and stuff like that. And that was like his tradition he did every October. So my dad died in a hotel room Getting up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, I'm guessing, he tripped and fell and broke his neck on a table. So he died instantly, which I think is probably what he would have wanted. And he died doing what he wanted to do, you know. And we went over to my brother's house to talk about the funeral and things like that. And they didn't want to have a funeral for my dad because my dad wasn't religious, right? And I said, well, that doesn't matter. We still have to have a service for him. You know, my mom was like, well, I don't think Chuck would have wanted that. And I said, well, we need to have that. We need to have some sort of remembrance of his life. What are you talking about? You know, and it was just so funny that I was the person that kind of stood up for my father in that moment, because all of us had obviously had dealt with some of the stuff my dad had done to us in our childhood. And I was the one that was the most loving to him. You know what I mean? Like, I was the one that did that. And, I took a few days off work, and I worked for 3 days on this, like, photo, you know, thing that you do for people. Like, you just do all the pictures of their life and stuff like that. Oh, it was so healing. It was so wonderful. It was a really magical part of my sobriety. I'll never forget it, just being alone in my house with all those pictures and setting them up and making that for the service. And all the kids, we all wrote something and got up and said something. And it was really healing for me to do that. And I never had, like, a formal amends process with my father. That would have been awkward, I think. But I've always felt like that was a really, I don't know, like a meaningful ninth step in my sobriety to remember him in that way and to recognize all that he was and how much he meant to me. Because I have a lot of great memories of my dad when I was little. Like, he took me to Disney World when I was 8, and he would get in line at the next ride so that I wouldn't have to get in line. So I would get off the ride and I would be up the first line at the next ride, you know, things like that. Like, I remember all those things. And, you know, he taught me how to watch people. I remember we would go to, like, these outdoor cafes in D.C. and he'd be like, you got to watch all the people and make up stories about their life. And I would do that with too. And I do that with my kids now. So AA has given me a lot, you know. I mean, I remember someone in my family recently was annoyed with us because we forgave my father. I'm not going to go on too much about that, but I remember telling my sponsor I was really mad at this person for saying something about it. She's like, he's, you know, forgiveness is one of the most spiritually enlightened part of your life. And they don't get that, and that's okay. And it's so true for me, because forgiveness has been very powerful. And, you know, I sponsor a lot of women in AA, and my sister-in-law passed away 2 years ago, and this woman called me the last day I got to see my sister-in-law alive. This woman called me, who I barely had ever spoken to. God does this kind of stuff to me all the time. And I had seen my sister-in-law. She died of cancer, so she was very sick when I last saw her. She could barely talk. And I got in my car to drive home, and my phone rang. And it was Becky saying, hey, can you be my sponsor? And I swear that kind of stuff has happened to me so many times in my sobriety, where God just put someone in my life to help me deal with some sort of sorrow or tragedy in my life. And it's been such a blessing. And I had two women I sponsored drink last year, and it's been really hard on me. I will say that's my least favorite part of sobriety, is seeing the people drink. I've been to a lot of funerals. I've seen a lot of marriages fail, you know, where one person starts drinking and the next person follows, things like that. It's really scary. But you got to stay in the middle, you know. It really does work. You just got to stick in the middle, and don't get too far off the edges. My husband always says, don't get too comfortable. That's the secret. I agree with that, you know. Because if I was all better, why would I come here? but I'm not all better. I have a lot of work to do. You know, like I said, my fourth step, I feel like in my sobriety, my fifth step, you know, I got all my defects of character from working, doing my fifth step with my sponsor. And I kind of feel like every year, every 2 years or so, I'm dealing with like one particular defect of character more than any other. And this year it has to do a little bit of ego. I've been dealing with a little bit of low self-esteem because I, so ironic, I got diagnosed with celiac disease 2 years ago. So I'm a pastry chef, and apparently I can't be around flour. And I was pretty PO'd at God about that when it happened. I was like, what in the hell is this crap? You know, like, this is ridiculous. I was really, really talented at my job. I was really successful, and I got a lot of my ego from my work. And all of a sudden, I had to go to my bosses and say, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I guess, you know, you're going to have to find someone else to do this. And they were devastated. It's funny. It's like all about them. But but I was pretty devastated myself. You know, I was 42 when it happened, I guess. And I was not planning on a different career. I mean, I was planning on doing that until I was 60. You know, I mean, I love my job. And all of a sudden, my doctor was like, you've got to get the hell out of there. I said, oh, my God, what am I going to do? So they made me the program director. So I'm not in the kitchen anymore. I'm outside the kitchen, but I'm still there, you know, so it's all good. But it's been a challenging year. I started that position in June last year, and I'm definitely outside my comfort zone. You know, I'm doing a lot of things that I'm not comfortable with, a lot of writing and talking to people about things. And, you know, I'm a hands-on physical worker. You know, like, that's what I am. Like, I make the biscuits. I do the work. I'm on my feet, and all of a sudden I'm, like, kind of sitting down a lot. I'm going to use my brain, and that's a little scary for me. You know, I'm too stupid. I have a learning disability. I don't know how to study. I don't know how to learn things. Like, this is the chatter that's in my brain all the time, telling me that I can't do it, I can't do it. And I didn't realize I had any of that anymore because I thought, I'm successful. But all of a sudden, I had to start over. And so it's been really a challenging year for me, honestly. I've had a hard time. So I'm grateful that people ask me to come speak at meetings like this so I can, you know, remember my story, remember where I came from. I heard in a meeting the other day, I really liked it. They said, you know, you don't always have to be happy to be grateful. And I thought, you know, that's really true, because I'm not really happy right now. Like, there's some things in my life that I'm feeling frustrated with and struggles, and I'm scared and, you know, whatever. I'm alcoholic. But I am incredibly grateful. You know, I am incredibly grateful for my sobriety. I'm on borrowed time. You know, I would never have the things in my life that I have today if I wasn't sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm truly blessed. You know, but for the grace of God, there go I. So I don't know why I'm sober today, but I'll take it. Thanks for letting me share.